Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Over the past year, we followed six Appalachians as they tried to find a job, go to school, and decide whether to stay home or leave for better opportunities elsewhere. On today's show, we'll hear what's changed for the Appalachians in our Struggle to Stay series since their stories aired.
I've since started testosterone, which is a hormone replacement therapy. Yeah, and with that comes a lot of changes like the voice drop, hair, everywhere.
We'll reflect on what we learned after following them for a year as we helped them tell their stories.
It made me think more about how we all struggle with this internal idea of home. Rather than a physical kind of struggle, there's more of a personal struggle to call home your own and accept that even the places you love have their problems.
The struggle to stay 1 year later, that's all coming up next on Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The struggle to stay is not unique to Appalachia. We, as human beings, as we're growing up, we have to decide whether or not we're going to stay in the same town that we grew up in, or are we going to leave? But there are certainly unique struggles that we have here in Appalachia, like making a home in a place known as Ground Zero to the opioid epidemic, or breaking out of generational cycles of poverty unique to our mountains. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We'll be listening to two live events we recorded at the Appalachian Studies Association Conference this year and in 2017. The conversations explored our series, The Struggle to Stay, a reporting project in which we helped several people record themselves over a year of their lives as they wrestled with the decision to move away or stay in Appalachia. We kicked off the series last spring with a panel we hosted at the Appalachian Studies Association Conference at Virginia Tech. One of the guests on the panel was Cassidy Wright, a native of Harlan County, Kentucky. Her words get to the heart of the unique push and pull of our home in Appalachia.
It's such a struggle for me to make a place where I am. I was 17 years old, and my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and she lost her job due to her inability to work. She lost her home and ended up having to go live with her boyfriend's mom, and she felt like she couldn't take me there, and I ended up having to go leave my home that I had made for myself and go live in Jacksonville, North Carolina with my father. And I just remember having that piece of me ripped away and going to a place with no mountains and just the vastness of the sky with no mountains there just overwhelming me. And I just was feeling my Appalachian heritage being drained from me. And then once I graduated high school and was looking to go back and make a place for myself, I went back home. I went back to Eastern Kentucky into Harlan County and started going to college at Southeast Community and Technical College, where I work now. And it was such a amazing experience driving back up, because I'd been away for so long. I never got to come back and visit anyone. And I was driving back up, and I remember I was getting right into Virginia, right into the northern part of North Carolina, and the mountains were starting to pop up. And I remember just not even noticing, just tears just rolling down my face. And I was just like, I'm home, because I feel like the mountains were just like a mother to me, and they held me and comforted me whenever I didn't have that in a lot of spaces and times, and it's where I want to be.
Again, that was Cassidy Wright, a native of Eastern Kentucky. She was one of the guests on stage at a live event at last year's Appalachian Studies Conference at Virginia Tech. This isn't the first time I've heard someone explain that the surrounding Appalachian Mountains offer warm hugs. I've also heard people say that they feel suffocated by them and want to break free. Perhaps it depends on the struggles of life at the time. During this year's conference, we hosted another panel to discuss the struggle to stay. One of our panelists was Colt Brogan. He's lived in West Virginia his entire life. He grew up along the Coal River in Lincoln County. He's working for a farmer training program called Refresh Appalachia, learning to grow vegetables, raise meat, run his own business, and all the while, he's also getting his associate's degree at a community college. Before we share more on what Colt's up to today, let's listen to a bit of Colt's struggle to stay story from producer Roxy Todd.
Colt says everything changed in this community about 10 years ago when drugs like prescription pills and then meth and heroin started becoming more common.
On a normal day, on a completely normal day here, there's somebody in their car up there doing some drugs. There's like three people rolling a joint or a blunt down here. It's a normal day.
Colt remembers parties on the weekend here when he was in high school. But he also remembers when families would come here to swim together, something he hasn't seen in years.
You know, it used to be more beach, so there'd be more people basking in the sun, and the kids could play in the rapids that there used to be.
We stand beside the river and talk for maybe 20 minutes. I get the sense that Colt is basically a normal teenager. He grew up in a place just like lots of places that have changed.
And it's almost scary to see that change, to see what I feel is the drug epidemic changing the nature of the people to what they are today. And how it used to just not be like that. You know, the worst thing you'd ever hear about is maybe marijuana and some drinking. And now it's like your cousin Tommy's a meth head and your brother lives up Cliffside and is in a heroin den or something.
After we get back into his geo tracker, we drive past small homes, dog kennels, and chicken coops. Colt doesn't slow down as we pass his mom's house. He keeps his eyes on the road.
This is where I grew up. There used to be a trailer there, but we tore it down because of flood damage. And that's my mother's house. But I'm not welcome there anymore.
Colt and his mom haven't been getting along for years. But things came to a head when he stopped by her house for a visit a few days before this interview. They got into an explosive argument over money, he says. She wanted him to pay the taxes on a property she'd given him next door. He said he didn't want the property. It floods all the time. For years, Colt says his mom has repeatedly tried to get money from him. This time, he told her no.
My mom told me to leave. And she said, are you going to pay the taxes? And I said, well, I was probably not going to. And she got upset and started yelling and cussing and breaking stuff and asked me to leave.
Colt tells me his mom has struggled with drug addiction since he was a little kid. Later, I ask his mom if this is true. She says addiction is something from her past. It's how she dealt with abuse she's experienced from men in her life. As for this fight over money, she says she was angry that Colt wouldn't help pay the taxes, but that she didn't throw him out of the house. Colt moved out of his mom's house 2 years ago, just 4 days before his 18th birthday. He doesn't look sad when he talks about it. He's angry.
But there's nothing for me at that house. It's nothing but bad memories anyway, mainly.
We turn around, and this time he does slow down as we pass his mom's house again. There's a nativity scene, surrounded by blooming flowers.
Despite everything, she always had a green thumb, and I think that's somewhat where I got my green thumb. It's from my mother. Like, anything she would plant, she's planted a little bit of everything. Flowers and crops and stuff like that. And everything I've ever seen her plant has grown with almost no maintenance. It's strange.
Here's what Colt shared at the most recent Appalachian Studies conference.
So catch us up. What's going on now? That was just right at the beginning when we heard from you, there was a lot of heavy stuff. What's going on now?
So that was about a year ago. And I can really tell, you know, listening back at my story, how much that was on my mind and how heavy it laid on me, all the drug-related things in my life as a young man. And I've been lucky to be able to get away from that, with my job that I have now and living, you know, just far enough away to not, I guess, have to be involved in with the people and the and stuff that I was as a kid, you know, because I lived that, you know, there my whole life. And then, as you know, when I turned 18, I moved to another place, and then I got a job there, and you know, things have changed for me at the very least. And my mom's still struggling with her, you know, addiction and stuff, and it's hard, you know, to have a family member like that. But I think they kind of have to learn to get over that, and I don't know how much outreach can help them. I just don't really know. So still a struggle, I guess.
Once again, you can feel the push and pull of home in Colt's words. He feels connected to his family, but he's also trying to stay focused on getting the training he needs to earn a living. We'll hear a bit more from Colt later in our show. And in next week's episode, we'll share more of this story with a new update about his plans after he graduates from the Refresh Appalachia program. That's next week, right here on Inside Appalachia. Next, we're going to hear from another Struggle to Stay participant, Kieran Dahl, who also traveled with us this year to the listening session we hosted at the Appalachian Studies Conference, along with the reporter who produced his stories, Liz McCormick. Kieran works as a server at a restaurant by day. By night, he's working on running a new theater company he launched with some of his friends. Kieran also identifies as a transgender man. He was born a female, and actually at the time we were following him, he wasn't yet passing as a man. Here's a quick reminder of Kieran's Struggle to Stay story.
Hi, folks. My name is Kieran. I am also living in West Virginia. I'm located in the Eastern Panhandle, and I'm like multimedia freelancer and a theater artist and an open trans man.
And I think that when we introduced you on the Struggle to Stay, that we referred to you as Kira, but now it's Kieran, right?
It's the extra little N. Yeah, one letter.
Yeah, just one letter. But still important, and I've been making notes this whole time to make sure. Okay, so let's hear, this is a portion of Kieran's story.
Just a few days after this interview, I attended the second day of auditions for Kira's latest production, William Shakespeare's classic tragedy, Hamlet.
Ben, first lines, had I but time, monosyllabic, slow down.
Auditions were held at Kira's parents' house, just a few miles from the heart of Shepherdstown.
But let it be, once again, monosyllabic, use that period as a pause, Horatio, I am dead.
Shakespeare has actually played a large role in Kira's life. In fact, it was one of the playwright's other plays, A Midsummer Night's Dream, that was a turning point for Kira.
When I was in junior high, I was in my first Shakespeare play. And I was really confused. Everybody's hormones were crazy and vicious. And so were the people. And I didn't really fit in with the girls. I was really bad at being a girl. I'm still really bad at being a girl. And I didn't really fit in with the boys because I still was a girl. At least I thought. And I got bullied really hard.
Kira says this point was the most difficult time of their life. Kira was beginning to recognize they were genderqueer and struggling with identity.
I just felt so lost and confused and kind of empty. And I really genuinely thought that, like, if things didn't get better by high school, I would try to opt out in whatever way that applied, whether it meant, like, leaving, running away, or, like, actually attempting suicide, whatever that looked like. I knew that that was very real for me because I just did not enjoy what was going on at the time. And that's, like, nobody's fault. It really isn't. But that's how I felt mentally.
Things changed for 12-year-old Kira when they were cast as Helena in A Midsummer Night's Dream, a character who's an outcast and no other characters seem to love. Kira connected with Helena to a T, and for the first time, Kira felt in control.
It finally gave me something to connect to, and as a weird 7th-grade kid who doesn't know how to act like a person or a girl, that was a really big deal. That was a really big deal. I learned that I could pretend. And if I could pretend, I could make it through. And then in learning how to pretend, I realized everybody else was doing the exact same thing, sometimes without realizing it. So it took me out of that very vulnerable place of feeling very put down by my peers and by myself and being in a weird body and not knowing what that was and coming into a queerness that I did not know I had. And it gave me not just an activity, but like a philosophy, like a way of life to kind of fake it till you made it or fake it till you fake it some more. And although that sounds kind of terrible, that is absolutely what I needed in that moment. And that's part of the reason that theater is like my life. It's my philosophy. It's my world. It's how I see the world. And it saved my life.
A few years after playing Helena in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Kira came out as bisexual to friends and family, and that was tough.
I would say that there are definitely some growing pains, but my family supports me as a person pretty much unconditionally, and I hope to see those growing pains actually be real growth in both their person and mine and our relationship. It's hard, I'm not gonna lie.
And then during their senior year of high school, Kira came out as genderqueer or gender fluid.
Being a pansexual non-binary person just means I don't necessarily identify really strongly as both male or female. I just simply feel kind of masculine, and that's just fine. So I'm just a person. That's all that means.
So Whiskey Shine and Pantomime's production of Hamlet came to a close. Kira started writing an original play they hoped to showcase for the public in the summertime, and Kira continued to juggle a handful of jobs and lived paycheck to paycheck. And then, in May 2017, Kira got hit with some big news. Kira learned their mother, Kathleen Daw, and father, Brighton Daw, were moving out of West Virginia to Colorado for a job opportunity. Now, Kira's conflicted whether to follow them, especially for their mom.
Because I don't think I'm just my mom's kid. I think that I'm one of my mom's best friends. And my best friend's moving away. So that's really scary. But it is good. It is a good thing. But it's sad that they have to leave me to do it. But my family was certainly an incentive to stay in West Virginia because I had my family here. But now I don't really have that. So it is conflicting because I'm the only one here now. And of course my parents want me to follow them to Colorado. And it is tempting. There's a lot of cool stuff down there. But I'm not ready to leave here. My life is here.
Thank you very much, Kieran, for sharing your story. Now, I have to point out, the voice in that sounds a whole lot different than what we heard
before.
Yeah,
it's a little different now.
So catch us up. What's happened since then?
Oh, man. So we have, in just like kind of the objective like time frame for me, we put on, I think, 3 shows since then, which is super cool. And, you know, just our company is just becoming a little bit more prolific. And that's really exciting. And it's also just exciting as a performer to be able to be doing like more and more things, right? It's like doing, you know, just like adding to your plate. So that's really cool that that is being supported by our community and that that's like succeeding, right? I've since started testosterone, which is a hormone replacement therapy, which a lot of like trans or non-binary people go through. So basically I get my testosterone through a tiny needle in my butt every week. And it's not the best thing in the world, but at the same time, it makes me feel a lot better. And yeah, and with that comes a lot of changes, like the voice drop, hair everywhere. And yeah, of course, and of course how people treat you in the everyday, right, in the day-to-day, because people do treat me very differently now that I'm a passing white male and I walk through this world quite differently. So that's definitely been a really interesting experience. I've been on T for, I think, 9 months, so it's like a little bit after our last checkup. And I am also contemplating leaving West Virginia for other job opportunities out west. And I'm kind of struggling with that right now. And because if somebody offers you security on a plate, do you say no? You know, what do you do? But at the same time, you know, I don't know if I want to just up and move to the other side of the country and leave my, you know, my extended family. It's my, you know, my Ohana, just like my friends. Those are the ones that I spend Christmas with, you know. So that's just up for viewing right now.
You mentioned your mom being your best friend and moving out to college. Yeah, things are still good with that.
Yeah, no, and I think that with the distance has come a lot of healing and growth in that relationship, which is really exciting. Because, I'm not, you know, don't get me wrong, my mom's a woman from the 50s, you know? So me being a non-binary, pansexual, you know, queer person it's different and it's new. And I'd say that it's also like a generational thing. Like for our generation, I think it's a little bit different. It's still just like new, but I don't know. It's not as new to us and as it might be to someone who has gone 50 years of their life not knowing that this was even a thing. And then all of a sudden, your child is completely different. And I understand that that's hard, but I think that the distance has been really positive. And I mean, I've gone vegan in this time. So that's also a change that she is having to cope with because I can't no longer eat her Johnny Marzetti pastas and things. So, you know, but no, I mean, I think it's good. I think it's all like good growing pains, and it's been good for me because I got to kind of reclaim some of my own independence from them. It wasn't that I was living with them or anything, like, you know, it was just like being able to be separate and be able to be my own person for a minute is so important, and not have their, I suppose, like, you know, issues and problems, and just even in the day-to-day of like, oh, I have a cold today, you know what I mean? I don't have to be necessarily super concerned with that, and that's been very freeing, although, of course, I, you know, concerned son, obviously.
We've been listening to a live panel we recorded this spring at the Appalachian Studies Association Conference. One of the most gratifying aspects of producing this series has been seeing how stories that on the surface seem very different actually connect up in interesting ways and sharing those connections with you. Here's Colt again.
Meeting Karen for the first time and stuff, I thought our struggle would be a lot different, but it's like there's some similarities, like finding your place and employment and it being accepted. I mean, theater's hard, I'm sure, to convince people that it's like relevant, and so is farming. So there's a lot of similarities that I wouldn't have thought. But, you know, like educating people and getting it accepted.
We'll talk more about the sometimes unexpected connections and common ground between our participants' stories later in the show. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear more from this conversation. We'll talk about the universal struggle so many of us face to feel settled, whether we leave the town where we grew up or stay home. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today, we're reflecting back on our series, The Struggle to Stay, 1 year later. We've been listening to a live event we recorded in Cincinnati, Ohio at the Appalachian Studies Association Conference. The event is normally held in Appalachia, but this year the theme explored issues of migration and population loss as people have moved beyond our borders to cities across the world. When we set out with this project, the goal was to look beyond the statistics about people moving away from Appalachia. Portions of Appalachia are bleeding population, and we wanted to figure out why. Because we knew the statistics and the numbers might say one thing, but the individual stories might help us to reveal something else. In this next part of the discussion, I asked one of the reporters, Roxy Todd, who helped Colt Brogan tell his stories, about what lessons she took away from this project.
In your experience in following Colt, what did you find?
I would just say that for Colt's story, as somebody who grew up in Tennessee and kind of struggled, like instantly wanted to leave, I think this is a universal feeling that home is kind of this internal struggle we have. It's not just like a place, but we always have these, I don't know, these personal struggles. And Colt's story is just really powerful in a unique way because he loves his home so much, but he has this love-hate relationship with things that he grew up with and the family he's tied to. And I just found that that story was, it made me think more about how we all struggle with this internal idea of home, whether we want to leave or whatever. There's something inside of us that we call home, and it's like our memories. And sometimes those memories are conflicted. And I found that Colt's conflict, inner conflict with like his mom and his home, that struggle is something that we all feel, whether we struggle to leave. And so that was just like a unique thing with Colt's story that I found really fascinating. Rather than a physical kind of struggle, there's more of a personal struggle to call home your own and accept that even the places you love have their problems.
What do you think, Colt? Does that sound pretty, can you add anything to that?
I think that's right, you know. I mean, which the question was directed to her, and I think that I don't want to comment on what she's saying, but I would just say that, like, I've found home in gainful employment, and which I know sounds like really like nothing, but I'm sure we've all had trouble finding that. So, like, I've found home in a purpose, and you know, a cause to be here, I guess, and money so that I can stay.
So did you ever think about leaving, though? I mean, it was about the job. You thought about leaving if you'd have to find a job?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to stay just because I'm familiar with it. I mean, I need a purpose. I think that's important for all of us probably, but that was really important for me. I needed to go where I was needed most.
How has the process of telling your story for the Struggle to Stay series affected your life? In a positive or negative way? Do you think it's opened up some things to make you realize things, or has it changed anything?
I think a lot of my story, it starts with addiction, I guess. So it's like I can be kind of an advocate for getting over your shame and moving to the next steps, because I think people get caught up in the shame and then maybe just stay where they are because they're comfortable with the people around them, because they're also like them and they don't make them feel shame. It is a struggle, but I mean, I think it's worth getting over that and then meeting those new people so that you don't feel shame. I mean, I feel like that's all part of that struggle with addiction, or with where maybe you weren't an addict or you just came from it. You still kind of are put under the same umbrella of being an addict. So, yeah.
Colt is working towards living a different life than the one his mother has lived, and he can't help but to wish that his relationship with his mother could be better. It almost seems similar to how some of our Struggle to Stay participants feel about their homes in Appalachia. A desire to reach for more than this place seems to be offering them, and yet a conflicting desire to keep it close. Earlier in our show, we heard from Kieran Daw, who was recently offered a job out west, which he's considering taking. It would bring him closer to his parents, who've relocated to Colorado, and it would bring him more financial stability. But he'd have to abandon his friends, as well as the theater company he helped start in West Virginia.
But you've mentioned, and we reported and we heard in the Struggle to Stay, that there were a couple of shows that were pretty successful.
Yeah.
But you're Still thinking about leaving? Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really hard because, like, we've made this, we've built this, you know, company from the ground up. It's been this, like, grassroots thing. It's literally, you know, gone from people's basements and out of the pennies out of our pocket just to, like, put a show together and get people costumed and whatever because we just believed in doing it. And we thought it was important. We thought it was important for the community to see shows that had to deal with suicide and shows that had dealt with family trauma and shows that dealt with, you know, addiction and loss and betrayal. And these are just real things, you know, these are just real things that we deal with. And so it's very important to see that played out, I think, because it allows for some processing. So it, to me, it's no surprise that we have been pretty successful. It is continuing that success. It's like, that is the really hard part. And that is part of the reason I'm contemplating leaving is because I don't, like, how long can one person just kind of carry on and keep on doing that and organizing when, you know, we have this very small little community of support, and that's very, really, that's really integral to our shows and to what we do as a company. But it's very frustrating because then to get that outward momentum going is still then put upon you. And that just gets so tiring after like 5 years of doing it and then still being like, you know, we even got the radio to recognize we're a real company. Oh my gosh. And then you go and you try and book a venue and they're not going to book you because even though you're a real LLC, even though you're a real company, you're still what, young, it's still entertainment. Nobody wants to see that. Why do we care? Bye. You know, and that's just constant. And, you know, just kind of degrading because I don't think that we would get that if we were in a city. I think that that's what it is like accessibility to the resources necessary to make it happen.
So gaining legitimacy is part of the challenge, but is it the finances? So it sounds like you're popular, you've got people to come. There's still a challenge in getting that recognition though. So is it, you know, actually being able to make a living with that?
Yeah, for sure, because I can't ask my actors to take off work every week to make the show unless I can pay them enough. And our numbers look like if we attempted to do this full time, we could maybe make it work, you know? Like that was the goal, right? Is to create basically a minimum wage job for actors. Because it is a real talent and it is a real skill. And that has proved to be possible and extraordinarily difficult. Because of the day-to-day, right? That's the thing, is that in theory, all of this is amazing. And if we had funding, no doubts about it, we could do it. But we don't really have any funding. Our funding comes from ourselves, or from our shows, and what we pull in from that. And like, to us, that's a couple $100, and that's awesome, you know? That's amazing to have a couple $100 as a budget for another production. Holy cow, you know, that's a paycheck, right? But I think that in like the longer scope of things, like I can't ask people to trust me with something as crucial to their day-to-day, such as a paycheck and money. I don't know if I want to have that like responsibility of letting people down if someone doesn't come to a show, because we have not received proper like funding, or we didn't promote enough or something like that. It's just so variable. And if we were in a city, yeah, we could probably count on more consistency, but we're not. So it's a little bit more inconsistent.
How do you think being a part of the struggle to stay and being able to tell your story, how has that impacted your life and your perspective on your decision to stay or go in a positive or negative way?
I mean, I think that it was really fun to do this show in general, because you have to be aware of, you know, what are you doing right now? You know, what are the sounds around you right now? And just keeping those things in mind while tracking a year and a half of your life.
Kieran, I want to ask you, and I want to think about stereotypes for just a little bit, because there's been a conversation around Appalachia saying that we're not very accepting of the LGBTQ community. And I don't know if you've encountered that. It seemed like in hearing your story that you have a supportive group in the Eastern Panhandle in West Virginia. Explain to us your experience here and also what you know about other people's experience in Appalachia.
So, I mean, I'd say that definitely like our little area is much more accepting. I know that a lot of the trans people that have come from other parts of West Virginia like it where we're located a little bit more because there is a larger community. People are generally a little bit more accepting. So for me, like my privilege, or like my experience is like a privileged one, and it's isolated, right? It's isolated to this nice little area, this like happy little pocket, which is cool and been really nice for me, of course. But I think that other parts of West Virginia are not nearly as accepting. But once again, I've also met a lot of other trans people that are like down in Fayette County and down in like, you know, I mean, in Davis and stuff like that. And like, they're going on living their lives, you know? So these people definitely exist. And I think that their experiences are really on a more like person-to-person basis. And it's about like, you know, where you are and how your family reacts and how your friends react and, you know, your teachers, your mentors, your job. You know, I'm very fortunate that like when I came out, my job, like they changed my name on like my pay stub, you know, and that was so cute, right? But like, but that they could have fired me, you know, and it would have been totally legal for them to do that, right? So it really just depends. It's completely based on to preference, and that's part of the reason why I feel it's really important to be out, even though I would rather just be stealthy, as they call it, you know, be stealth, you know, you just kind of go by and nobody knows, right? Just like, but, and it's easier to do that, of course. But I think that it's important to not do that because it raises the awareness that like, oh yeah, no, these people that you're making laws about, like they exist.
And Colt, I want to talk with you some about stereotypes as well. You know, it's difficult. I think the conversation can be difficult when you talk about stereotypes. There's been a few times since I've been working as the host of Inside Appalachia that I've heard people say, well, we're not all like that. And when they say that, they're quickly turning away from a certain group of people or this certain stereotype. And a lot of times, that stereotype explains my family to a T, a lot of times. So at the same token, you know, being a lifetime resident of Southern West Virginia, my father was worked in the coal industry, was killed in a mining accident. My grandparents, I found out not too long ago that my grandmother didn't graduate from high school and my grandfather didn't pass middle school, didn't get out of middle school. So you talk about like uneducated things, but they were fantastic people who taught me more about farming and who taught me more about, you know, surviving than I ever learned in college. So that's one thing when we talk about these kind of stereotypes, I think that makes the comp for me personally and also in this job that makes it kind of challenging and difficult. And I just wonder, Colt, if there's, you talked some about shame and about, you know, your past and things like that. Is there anything that you might be able to talk about as far as your connection or discussion in your life and stereotypes?
I'm from the southern part of the state, and I would say as many people fit the stereotype as break through it. So I guess that's kind of a hard one for me. I try to treat people as individuals, and like, and that I get along generally by doing that. Like if you treat someone like a stereotype, then like it's just, I guess it's just unfair, and then maybe you're more likely to get that stereotype out of them, even if it wasn't there, I guess. Or you don't actually get to know the person, I guess, if you treat them like a stereotype instead of like a person. But that's just how I feel, and I was lucky enough to have family that taught me that way. That would take me to Charleston, to different places, because you can find a little bit of, like, all kinds of different culture in Charleston if you go to the right place. So, and taught to respect them as individuals, not as, like, black people or gay people or whatever, you know, rich people, poor people. Like, just respect them for who they are and talk to them like they're people. And so I don't have like issues with people or stereotypes, I guess, because of that. It seems general, but you do see people like hate on all kinds of groups of people, especially where I'm from. So
The truth in this conversation was refreshing. While we don't want to see hate in our communities, it does exist. And there's some truth to the stereotypes of Appalachia not being a very welcoming or diverse place. But Kieran's description of his experiences in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia is different, and it doesn't fit that Appalachian stereotypical mold. And yet, they both say they love this place anyway. And in the next part of our discussion, we invited the audience to join in the conversation.
Hey, thanks for a great session. My name is David Long. I live in the Daniel Boone National Forest in eastern Kentucky, actually in an unincorporated area near Moorhead. I'm a faculty at Moorhead State University, and we get your program on Sundays. through our universities to thank. It's a great program. I'm actually going to, I have a question actually for the folks, all the national the public radio staff here. So I'm curious about narrative framing, right? So you have someone who's economically marginalized, dealing with local issues of poverty, drugs, the people up on the hill in the brick houses, and the people who are the river people. You have someone dealing with gender identity and that transition in an area which is arguably hard. What's left unstated? Like, so we're talking about the struggle to stay. What are the people who have the economic means to stay, and why are they not part of the conversation here? It's like we're talking about marginalization, but we're not actually interrogating like the dominant forces that are controlling the politics in the state, both in West Virginia and my state of Kentucky, and why those people who are part of the creative class largely get out and leave, and who stays and why. So like looking forward, what are we gonna do? Like what's part of your narrative that way? So the folks who are in the brick houses, I'm thinking if I went to counties that I'm really familiar with, say like Pike County, Kentucky, you know, like those who are dominant in the coal industry, who can largely come in and out as they want, mm-hmm. right? And so they don't have to ask those questions of, am I staying or am I going? Or folks who work in entertainment, work in film, work in a theater and go, you know, I've got to go to a city because that's where the opportunities are. Why do we not have anyone in this panel? Like, this is all about marginalization. Why is there not someone here who's part of the dominant culture, both economically or by ethnicity or by class, to kind of push back directly on them?
Our producer, Roxy Todd, gave this answer to David's question.
I would just say that, I don't know, I think in West Virginia, I think the dominant class is struggling. And I think even though there are a lot of people that are doing okay, I think even if you're upper class, middle class, coal family, those people are struggling too. And for this project, we really wanted to give voice to people who aren't often out in the spotlight, who just don't have the means to stand up maybe or haven't been asked to speak at a city council meeting or something like that. So the project was really about how do I give a microphone to somebody for a year and say, document your life. And we sort of did a lot of scouting for the stories that were out there that we felt that's a story that I haven't heard enough of their real internal struggle. Maybe I've heard about them, but I haven't heard it from their own voice. So we kind of looked for people who were maybe we didn't hear their perspective from their own voice. And I don't know if we were searching for people that were marginalized per se, but really people that had some really tough stuff they were going through internally. So,
hi, my name is John Connolly. I grew up in around West Virginia, mostly in Upshur County, West Virginia. These days I work as a teacher, teaching college in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I think Colt spoke a little bit to some of the change that something like this has some potential for. And I share the earlier questioner's concerns about framing, but I guess I want to try to pull something out that I find might be really useful out of the way this is presented. And Cole, I thought it was really rad and really interesting when you said, you know, there are a lot of similarities that I didn't really think about, and being involved in this project helped me like think about some of those similarities. And you said something like, you know, I think theater is probably really hard, I'm sure, and so is farming. You know, and it's difficult for people to like recognize that both of these things are really tough to do and tough to get recognition for. And I think that being willing, you know, to make these connections, to look around and to say, you know, it's not the theater's people's fault that farmers are having a hard time, and it's not the farmer's fault that theater people are hard time, and it's not the teacher's fault that all of us are having a hard time. You know, being willing to make these kinds of connections for working people in the state to look around and see what we have in common and see the ways that, you know, your difficulty of transition and my difficulty of transition usually get talked about in really different ways, but we actually have a lot to say to each other and a lot in common about these kinds of things. To me, pulling something like this out is a potential that we can do. It's something that we can take from it. Now, I think it's on us to take it from that, you know? The narrative framing is not going to tell us what to do with this, but it seems like, you know, Colt and Kieran are sitting here saying and talking about the things that they've realized and they've begun to think about, And I think that we can try to make those connections as listeners, and we can take these lessons and try to put them in practice in our own communities and in our own political projects.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah, of course.
I just want to say, like, so someone wiser than me said that a lot of issues around this area come from identity, an identity crisis. And I don't think that that's going to change. I mean, I think that's people, maybe we just struggle with identity, especially during the younger stages of our life. But what's helped me is just education, and that, you know, whether that's book learning or personal experience. I mean, I just think being more educated about a situation can help you at least say, oh, well, okay, I understand it now. And maybe it doesn't have to be such a crisis. It can just be a fact. And then it helps me move on. You know, especially addiction. Looking at an addict and reading about addiction can be two different things. Mm-hmm. And there's, you might have a lot of questions that go unanswered. But I think it, reading it about addiction and kind of trying to study it has helped me understand like what I need to do, and as like to deal with it, I guess, and to understand those people and maybe why they make their decisions, and that maybe I. Can't directly like change their decisions, like, you know.
If I can say really quickly too that, you know, our logo for Inside Appalachia is a bridge, and when we Roxy and I started working on the show and we reformatted the show and worked on it, you know, part of our goal was to try and, you know, bridge some of those gaps and connect people, and our strategy with the show in doing that is to get down to the human aspects of life and reveal as much, be as human as we possibly can with the reporting in it as possible. I think that's, so that's, I think, a huge compliment for our work and what we do, and I really appreciate it. If I could go back really quickly to, and I'm sorry, the gentleman from Moorhead. I thought about it a little bit more, and one thing that I do struggle with that I think maybe as far as the bubble and staying in this bubble, and I think it is really important that we don't stay in that bubble. As a communications professor at Concord University, we talk a lot about the echo chamber. And it is a challenge, I think, in media to get outside of our echo chamber and our comfort zone for in a lot of different areas, to talk to people with not only different values and morals and religious beliefs, but also different political views, which can make us feel really uncomfortable. And I think it's an excellent point that you make with, you know, also making sure that we're talking to people in power as well. And I don't know if that's where you were going, but it got me thinking about that. And it's something that frustrates me every day, that infuriates me, and that is probably the most challenging part of my job, I think, is to try and bust it.
Today we're looking back at the struggle to stay 1 year later. One of the producers of this series, Roxy Todd, reflected a bit more on staying, going, and how finding a home in Appalachia has changed during the course of this reporting project.
1 year after my coworkers and I launched this series, I can't help but think how much more of the story there still is to tell. I'm not sure a long-term project like this ever feels finished. I'd like to stay in touch with the people we followed during the next few years and find out what happens to them. These people had a deep impact on me personally. I've seen them at some of their saddest points, their most angry, and their most hopeful. I've seen them stubbornly keep on course and stay true to their goals, even during the toughest and most stressful times. One thing that I think unites these stories is the belief that finding a home, a job, and feeling settled is one of the most difficult struggles we human beings ever face. It can be degrading if potential employers never return your calls. It can feel soul-crushing if what you imagine does not pan out, especially if you moved across the country to find out the hard way that rent is much more expensive than you'd expected. For some of us, it's critical to find a place for ourselves. Colt Brogan discovered that finding peace with a self-identity was mostly tied to finding a secure job. Through interviews, Colt taught me that sometimes the desire to find your place in the world can also be tied to how you feel about your family and the place where you grew up. You want to be your own person, but you also can't totally shake your connection to those who raised you. As we become adults, I think many of us wrestle with who we want to be. And sometimes that means letting go of some of the past, of the people and places we knew as children. But we can't completely leave behind our memories, can we? I've begun to think of this struggle as sort of an inner search for home, and it seems to be at the root of so many of these stories. There's a unique longing for home in Appalachia, I think, because we have a much deeper sense of home. It's rare and special, and I think that's what keeps drawing me back to these stories.
This series has a special place in my heart. Right now, in my home, as there might be in yours, there's a conversation around surviving in Appalachia or thriving somewhere else. Will the rat race be the same somewhere else? When I think about moving away, I wonder if I'll even matter in another place. I love helping my neighbors and seeing people around me succeed. Lord knows we have a lot of needs around here. But helping others is also, for me, it's a purpose to stay here, to live with the comfort of knowing that I have a purpose and an opportunity to fill a void of some kind. Sure, it's nice to know we're not alone, but it's also most comforting to know that I'm unique or special, that I have something to offer in this place that nobody else can offer. These stories revealed more than just our reasons for staying or going. They also pointed towards some of the unique values and priorities we hold most dear. A number can't define the heart and soul of a culture, community, or person, and as we suspected, we found individual, complicated stories from people with this love-hate relationship with a place they fiercely protect. Home is a place that helps to make us who we are, and to me, rejecting the place, in a way, is rejecting yourself. So by moving away, does that mean that you're rejecting that place? Because I'm proud to say that my family and I have survived in this rugged terrain despite the odds, and I'm looking forward to overcoming more. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia.
Someone's always leaving here. It's just that kind of place. It's just that kind of world today. You learn to live with loss. The grass is always greener there, just on the other side.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Liz McCormick, Glennis Board, Chuck Klein, and the Appalachian Studies Association. Music in today's show was provided by Colleen Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
But a few of us are staying, and it's not a point of choice. It's not we who do the choosing. We are chosen by the place. And West Virginia chose me, sure as my own mother knows me. If I leave you, West Virginia, it don't matter where I roam. I don't know where I'm going.